I was reading some words of Anandamayi Ma, who is a great woman saint, master visited and wrote about in Autobiography of a Yogi, calling her the joy-permeated mother. She was a very saintly woman. She lived until 1982 in India. Swami Kriyananda spent a great deal of time with her. She's sort of considered our aunt. She's not actually in our line of gurus, but she's our aunt, and she sort of takes care of us a lot of times when our mother and father are away. And she's even though she was a delicate and a beautiful woman, I never had the good fortune of meeting her, although David did. Swamiji said she was small form, female form, but powerful like a general. He said when she would walk, the floor would shake, even on her tiny, delicate feet. She had all that power. And she spoke with great force, and over many, many years, she was recognized as saintly from a very young age, and people took down her words. And all of that is just to say that there was a conversation recorded, and someone quoted to her this oft-quoted statement: even if a room is in darkness for thousands of years, as soon as even a candle flame comes in, the darkness disappears. And when it was quoted to her, I guess she knew why it was being offered, because she suspected the motive of the person who was saying it, and she laughed and said, oh yes, everyone loves to quote this, but nobody talks about how you're going to get rid of the stink because the room has been closed up in darkness for so long. And she says, do your sadhana, because that was obviously the point that this person was trying to get out of. I'll just wait for that spark of light to come and then it'll all be solved. Now, of course, masters say different things at different times to different people. So you can't take every single thing that a saint or a master says is being all-encompassingly true. When Swamiji spoke to Master, to Yogananda, and said, oh, sir, help me to overcome my attachment to good food, Master just laughed at him and said, oh, when ecstasy comes, everything goes. And so he was almost saying the opposite, just try to bring the light into the room and then the room will be illuminated. But Anandamayi Ma was saying, there also is a lot of work that has to be done. And our Gita and our Bible reading, the way Swamiji has written it, is all about that aspect of it. And our own part in cooperating with the flow of grace and then responding to it in such a way that not only will the light expand, but we can get rid of the stink of the ages from all the time we spent not doing what we ought to do. Jesus' way of saying things is always just a little bit harder to grasp, because he was speaking in an age which was Kali Yuga descending, the lowest stage of consciousness on this planet going down, which if we think things are bad now, the good news about living in Kali Yuga going down is that you don't have to mess with society at all, because there's no hope of rescuing the culture as a whole. So if you're a spiritual person, you just get to turn your back on it, which is a very attractive idea a lot of times. As we are in Dwapara Yuga rising, where the energy of the planet is getting more and more expansive, we do things like this. We put a temple on El Camino Avenue, and we try to plant seeds that instead of being snuffed out by the assault of the barbarians, which happens at the bottom of Kali Yuga, even historically, we'll see an age in which something like this will gradually take deeper and deeper root and expand farther and farther. Among the many reasons why we're trying to make this temple free and clear of all debt, to just have it stand here, and it's a physically powerful building and can stand here really for many generations, and we're planting it not only for ourselves but for truth seekers now and forever, is how we affirm that. Well, when Jesus is saying here, he's talking about the darkness goes to the darkness and the light goes to the light. And Swamiji, in just a few sentences, he has such a marvelous way of saying this. He said, our negativity, every level of consciousness has its own attracting power. And I was thinking about this because I was asked a question, how do you get rid of negative thoughts? And Swamiji tells an interesting story once about during the period of time when he was working to build Ananda Village, and he was teaching every night of the week in cities from from Santa Rosa down, you know, down to the peninsula here, down to Palo Alto and Mountain View. And he would drive all over the Bay Area, and all the money he was earning was supporting the building, and then he was writing a book, books in the meantime, and he was just intensely busy, and the whole future of what you see in front of you was on his shoulders alone, virtually. And he was crossing the Bay Bridge, he said once, on one of those late night returns, and he felt cold germs, the germs of a cold coming into him. And, you know, everything is conscious. Germs are conscious beings. Here's a very strange, this is just peripheral, but Master said once, sometimes that epidemics that come, that invade planet Earth, like, the influenza and the Second World War, the First World War, and all those things that come, he said sometimes they are swarms of germs. They are low consciousness beings or high beings that have behaved badly, higher beings who have been sent down. They invade from lower planets and they come here to sort of do battle with us and ultimately to be annihilated. You know, what do you do with information like that, you know? But you can just sort of say, wow. But what he's really telling us is that how much consciousness is involved in everything. That we tend to think that things are just sitting there and that we can deal with them as material things. But what Master's telling us is everything is about consciousness. So Swamiji described going on the Bay Bridge and he felt these cold germs coming into him. And they're living things. And and he sort of watched them come in, and as they started entering into him, he said he observed the fact that part of the power of their negativity is that they made it seem important for him to relate to them. So he started relating to them, you know, well, gee, you know, maybe I need to have a cold right now. You know, maybe I've been too busy, and if I get a cold, it will just give me an opportunity to rest. In other words, just making his mind think that he needed to welcome this dark force into his life, that he needed to think about it. And then all of a sudden he realized what was happening to him. He was being hypnotized by these germs, and all alone in his car, and I can't imitate him, but in a very loud voice, he ordered them to get out, get out, get out right now. And they cringed and they left, you know, just like that. And he said he just didn't have time for them, and he didn't want to go there. Now he's explaining to us in our reading today in just a few sentences that the attractive power of negativity is the negativity that we ourselves have within ourselves. Oh, I'm tired, I'm overworked, people are really asking too much of me. You know, why am I the only one who has to do this? And even if, in fact, there might be some validity to that thought, there's different ways to think that way. You can say, Divine Mother, you've given me a great deal to do. I need your help. I'm feeling myself to be, you know, feeling weak by all this force. You need to strengthen me. Or you can look at the cold germs and think, oh, I'll just go with you. I'll just go down into tamasic energy. And it happens, and this is where the Bible says, if you do dark things, it draws more darkness to you. And we hide then from the light. Because negativity tells us that we need to relate to it. And if you go into the light, then you bring more light to you. And Swami writes, you know, whenever we do a wrong thing, isn't it so that that wrong thing captures our consciousness and tells us that we have to feel badly? Yogananda put it this way. He said, whenever you have a dark mood, he said, frankly, Satan has a hold of you. And far from being sort of real sympathetic, oh, I know, you feel badly about this and you feel badly about that. He just had no willingness to entertain it. When he came to Swamiji once and said to Swamiji, how are you feeling? And Swamiji said he was feeling a little down, and he got this far, well, he said, and Master said, that's good, you know, hearing the word completely differently than Swamiji had said it. But that's good. You know, you don't have to entertain these moods. They tell you you have to. And they use, as Swamiji said, your own false reasoning to persuade you. Well, after all, you know, the way I was raised, this is how I feel. And some very wise teacher, whose name I don't even know because it was repeated to me by someone else, said once, once something is past, it really no longer exists. All you have is the story you made up about it. And then you tell yourself that story over and over again, and it remains real, but it has no other reality except the story you tell yourself about it. Oh, I can feel everyone rebelling against that even as I say it. You know? Because negativity has its own power. But if we walk instead and say, okay, so whatever it was that happened, happened, you know, because all of us do remarkably unwise things on a fairly consistent basis. You know, just an unthought-out remark, an impatient response, why, oh, poor me, or why do they treat me that way? And then things, you know, happen in this world in which people really are mean to each other, and sometimes we're the object of that. People just have very strong opinions, and sometimes they express them, and sometimes they're caught up in gigantic negativities, you know, cosmic negativities, national negativities. Huge things really happen. And we still, they come to us. And we have to decide then, you know, where do I want to live in this? Because, and then here's the other sentence in Swami's reading that's just so interesting. He says, our faith is the attracting power. And I just really stop and think about that, our faith. What do we really believe is true? And then he says, it takes goodness to see goodness and evil to see evil, or as he puts it, to make special note of it. Because we can perceive evil happening around us, but to take special note of it and become really involved in its reality, we have to be in some way in it. Otherwise, we observe it from the outside with compassion, with honesty, but with compassion, and it doesn't hold us in the same way. When we were doing several hours of a retreat on Saturday before Easter, one of the very interesting parts of the Easter cycle is that just before Jesus' death, he did a certain amount to purge his followers, the group that was following him. He purged all the weak links out of the group. And it didn't mean in any way that he cast them out of his heart or cast them out of their relationship as disciples to him. That wasn't what he was doing. But he knew that after the crucifixion came, it would be a very challenging time for the disciples who were left, and they needed to be able to band together and give each other strength. And Jesus knew that there couldn't be many weak links among them. I mean, you know how it is in any group that you're part of. If you have somebody who constantly complains, who is filled with doubts, you know, who never really wants to put out energy, and you're trying to go somewhere or has a dissonant idea, even worse if they're strong, but their idea is slightly separate from yours. That was really the case of Judas. I mean, Judas nicely separated himself completely from the apostles by his own actions. But Judas was one of the 12, but he had a very different idea of how that mission should go, which he acted out by betraying him. But that's all the Easter story, so if you didn't hear it this year, you'll have to wait till next year. Okay? But the point is that he knew his disciples needed to be united. So he drove out deliberately from the group, not just the 12, but from the larger group, those who wouldn't have the strength, so that they could work together and go forward. And he did that by challenging them. And the most famous one that comes down is, eat my body and drink my blood. And the disciples didn't have the foggiest idea what it meant, and it sounded awful to them. I mean, we just get fragments of sentences, but you can imagine there was a greater context. And many walked with him no more. But you see, the interesting fact is, the test wasn't about Jesus. The test was about the faith of the disciples. Because when Jesus was, you know, arrested and crucified and then reputed to be resurrected, and not everyone saw him, the question was going to be for each disciple, what kind of faith did they have in their master now? You know, did they really believe? And did they have the kind of belief that when other forces came to challenge them, nothing could take it away from them? Because that's what they had to have at that point. So as part of that retreat, when we were meditating, I asked people, why don't you just meditate on what it is that makes you certain, if you are certain, about the existence of God, your relationship to this spiritual path, whatever it is that you define as your spiritual life. Don't just give a superficial answer to it. You know, the Bible says so. What do you really know in the deepest part of yourself to be true? I mean, I found it a fascinating exercise. Just keep backing up to the point where my own experience is irrefutable. And no matter what anybody said, no matter how different their experience was, it just simply could not touch mine. When Ananda was persecuted through a dozen years of lawsuits and, you know, just really accused of being a terrible cult that was abusive to the people in it, and the leaders were in it for themselves, and it was a great adventure. And when people would come to me about it, I would give them facts, but I tried hard not to persuade. Because I thought, if they're being persuaded by negative thought, I don't want to just persuade them by positive thought. Because all they're doing is being persuaded. Every individual needs to be able to stand somewhere and have their own experience and be able to stand in it no matter what swirls around them. So my answer would be, well, I don't know. What do you think? You know, you've been coming here for 6 months or 17 years. You know, what do you think? What is your actual experience? And then you find out how easily and quickly we can doubt our own experience, especially Americans. Americans are so afraid of being fooled. You know, we want to be sharp. We want to be cunning Americans. You know, really sharp. So we always have this, and the media really feeds this, you know. That, oh yeah, so-and-so looked good, but here's the understory about it. As soon as you know anything about what's printed in the paper, you know most of it is lies anyway. But nonetheless, you always feel like you don't really know. But where do you really stand? Because that is the attracting power of your consciousness. Because it's not a question of ideas. You know, you can have all the ideas in the world. People can say all kinds of things. Oh, yes, I'm a perfectly happy person, and I'm not the slightest bit mad about that. You know, I remember with Swamiji, I had a job once that I just couldn't do. And I was too ignorant, really, to understand how to ask for help. And I thought that I always had to just be a positive, you know, I just had to always say yes, even though the yeses were being piled upon more and more chaos and anxiety and insecurity. And we did it for about 2 years. And he just kept giving me more work, and I kept saying yes, and I kept producing nothing, and it was just ridiculous. I just didn't know how to say, wait a minute, help me. And so after about 2 years, it had reached such an impossible position that we sort of tried to reconcile it. And he said, you know, you always just tried to put on the right attitude. And then he smiled and said, but you never fooled me. I thought, oh God, what a waste of time. You know, it took me so much energy to hold up the facade and nobody was fooled. It's like, you know, you just have this little sign in front of you, like little kids do, you know, trying to pretend that something is true when everybody around can see it's not true. And in the universe, as we move through it, the universe doesn't really care what we're pretending to be. I mean, we don't even fool our friends, for heaven's sakes. Do you think you can, you know, fool God and the whole cosmos? It's what we are actually vibrating. And what we are actually vibrating is what we actually are and what our faith really is. And so the challenge to life, and it's a very interesting challenge, because on one hand, we are definitely trying to affirm and get into a reality that we may believe in, but we don't actually know. We don't actually know it. I was so amused on Easter when Graham did his song, which I'm going to try not to say because they will all be saying it all the time. For those of you who are here, he made some new words to one of the Mary Poppins tunes, and you cannot get it out of your head when you sing. But he was making magic words out of the state of samadhi, sabbakalpa, nirbhakalpa, samadhi. I mean, these are very big words. These are very big states of consciousness. And we're really trying to go somewhere that most of us don't wake up in the morning automatically in that state of consciousness. You know, from joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt again. Most of the time, Much of the time, a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. Eternity and I, one united ray. I mean, these words come out of my mouth a lot. I stand up here and I'm always telling you, you know, this is what we are. So we are going somewhere that we don't actually know. We don't know it like we know the bed we sleep in and the car we drive. So we have to be leaning upward. And at the same time, we also have to be just perfectly comfortable right where we're standing and not at all freaked out when we find out that we're standing even lower than we thought we were. I had this very difficult relationship that I had to fight through for the first 20 years or so of my spiritual life. And I really thought I'd gain some mastery over it. Just, you know, one karmic enemy. Swamiji says we're a very old spiritual family, so you don't only get your best buddies, you also get your worst enemies. Because we've been playing this in and out for a long time, and you know, jealousies and betrayals, and it's a very old story. So I had one of my worst enemies was in my life for many, many years, and finally we began to resolve it, and I was pretty proud of myself. This was no small victory. And then I got a little cocky and I started, you know, sort of hanging around the old enemy, thinking that we were really buddies now. And it didn't take more than maybe 2 hours, you know, before I was just as riled up as I'd ever been and as irrational in my responses. And I was so disappointed. I was in a car with Swamiji and I was crying, you know, in the car. Master said, well, sometimes tears are helpful and sometimes they're just pure cowardice. So I was weeping tears of pure cowardice in this case, and Swami was not impressed. And he says, why weep? He said, you thought you were free, so you weren't putting any energy into it, but now you find out you're not. This is good news. Well, you know, in effect, it really is good news. And the only reason I was weeping is because it was cowardly. Oh no, not this again. I was embarrassed for myself. I was exhausted from the effort. You know, all the different reasons, I mean, and the little voice that said, oh, now you can feel sorry for yourself. Don't put out any energy to overcome this. Just feel sorry for yourself and show how repentant you are by just weeping. That'll do it. Swami told me for years, you know, he said, all you do when you do something wrong is just feel badly. You don't really change. It took me really literally decades before I actually really realized that was true. Because I thought, if I feel really badly, see how repentant I am? But all I was really doing was just allowing my error to influence me and spending a lot of time thinking about it. I wasn't affirming goodness. I wasn't experiencing goodness. I wasn't using my willpower to transcend the egoic self-definition that was holding me down there. I was just spinning around in the negativity, and it had persuaded me that was the same as progress. You know, that's why when Swamiji said to Master, well, you know, what he was about to say was, well, it's been better, and then, you know, it might be worse. And no, he said the word, well, that's all we needed to hear. And Swamiji tells in another part of the path where that story comes from, that he did fall into a mood about something or another. And it started coming down that Master didn't really love him. And he, you know, he was such a worthless disciple. And he just, you know how you get started. Doesn't take long. And he was there. And he just kept trying to reason his way out of it. That's what negativity tells you. I'll just keep thinking about this. In fact, I won't even go to spiritual places. I can't go to Sunday service today because I'm so upset about this. You know, I just have to stay home and think about it. And I really can't meditate now because I really have to process this. All these different ways that the negativity tells you that it belongs in your consciousness. The cold germ is coming in and it's going to make you sick and that's going to be good for you. So Swamiji just got tired of feeling that way. He said, reason's not working. I'll see if changing my consciousness will work. And he had the willpower. He went into his meditation room and he chanted a bit. And then he applied his attention very strongly to the spiritual eye and did a few kriyas. And as soon as he had lifted his vibration into the reality that he could experience and he knew to be true, he just looked back at the negativity and just, I don't need that. Of course, Master loves me. What could I have been thinking? But the darkness doesn't want to come into the light. Because it knows as soon as it comes into the light, it's going to be obliterated. And so the power of the devotee is to use his willpower to really have faith and to work very hard to be very conscious of what you really believe in and to use that constantly to move you forward. You know, if you really believe in the power of God, and this is where the Bhagavad Gita's master writes about this particular verse, just shows itself to be so loving and so supportive. You know, this verse is, you know, be immersed in the power of God at all times. You know, just walk through this world never forgetting. And if you're not quite there, you know, then do those things that will remind you of God and will constantly bring you there. You know, do the discipline of meditation, of sadhana, of being with spiritual people. I mean, we've all experienced being a little down and then putting ourselves in a positive atmosphere and we find that we come up. So the Gita says, Krishna says to us, if you can't spontaneously always be conscious of God, then do those things that will help you to lift yourself up again. And if even that kind of concentrated spiritual work is too much for you, then do good works. Do works that are pleasing to me. And that means to work in a way that's pleasing to God, as well as to do those things that are pleasing. And that's why service becomes so important. Because often when our mind is spinning, I'm sure all of you experience, you just get active. You get busy, you do something, you make dinner for your family. You go find a friend, or you go walk your dog. You do something that puts your energy outside yourself, and you do it with an attitude of joyful service, and all of a sudden you find you're lifted again. And then he says, but if even in this thy faint heart fails you. You know, it's just so, this is the scripture. He's not shocked. God is not shocked that we have faint hearts. If even, you can't even walk the dog, you know, then bring to God the fact that this is all you have. That all I have is the fact that I can't even do this. Bring me thy failure. Swamiji actually translates it elsewhere and he says, bring me thy good intention, which is another way of saying it. I meant well, but this is the best I could do. Now, that pretty much covers it, doesn't it? And the scripture is saying, all of these offerings are beautiful in my sight because it's taking the darkness and bringing it to the light. And once we take the darkness and bring it to the light, well, even Anandamoyi Ma's response notwithstanding, darkness disappears in the presence of the light. And what we need to develop in ourselves, you know, and take the exercise if you weren't there on Saturday, take it home and try it. Find that which you truly believe in and cling to it mightily, whatever it might be. You know, whatever part of the spiritual path you absolutely own, hold tight to that and let that be the springboard from which you can rise higher and higher until eternity and I, one united ray, why not? You know, this is our destiny. One of the things when I had to do that exercise that I believed in, I absolutely believe in the happy ending. You know, I'm not at the happy ending, but for some reason I absolutely know it's there. And that's a very powerful belief because our faith is the attracting power. Do we really believe in the happy ending? Or are we somehow convinced that I alone and all of creation am actually separate from God and will be forever? And that I alone, even Judas couldn't separate himself from God, but I can. You know, seriously. Many people carry a belief like that, and then it reinforces and reinforces and reinforces. Find that point of truth where you can stand, plant both your feet there, and let nothing move you from it. And let that be the attracting power that draws you more and more of the bliss of our own nature. God bless you.